Hello, and welcome to the IT Pro Podcast. I'm Adam Shepherd, and with me is my co-host, Jane McCallion.
Hello.
Today, we're talking about the role of developers in organizations. Steve Ballmer, while he was still CEO of Microsoft, famously and vigorously expressed his love for this particular breed of IT professional in what has become known as the Developers, Developers, Developers speech at Microsoft's 25th anniversary celebration back in 2000.
While few people get quite so enthusiastically worked up about them, developers now play a more important role than ever before in driving business transformation. Dubbed the new kingmakers by Redmond co-founder Stephen O'Grady, devs are the beating heart of the ongoing software revolution.
But while they're vitally important, many organizations still struggle to effectively manage and operate their software development teams. To discuss the role of developers in the enterprise and how to structure a dev team is Evan Upton, founder of the Raspberry Pi Foundation and CEO of Raspberry Pi Limited. Evan, thanks for coming on the show.
Good to be here.
So, Evan, most people will know you as the face of Raspberry Pi, but you also worked at Broadcom for more than a decade and hold a PhD from Cambridge in computer science. Do you still do much development work yourself?
I do less development work than I'd like, certainly. Management has eaten my life. As I have to do more and more and more management, I have less and less time for development. And as you, when you get down to a certain level, you're just getting in the way, right? If I try and grab a piece of work at Raspberry Pi to do, then I'm going to do it so slowly that I'm an impediment. No matter how well I do it, I'm going to be an impediment. So I kind of don't in my professional life. I do try to keep doing a bit of development on my own time, though, because I have this fear. And what I've noticed is you get a lot of engineering leaders, engineering managers who are in their maybe the late 40s or early 50s who maybe once upon a time were great developers. It's this kind of Confucian thing about trying to learn from bad things. When I'm walking in the company of two other men, I'm bound to be able to learn from both of them. I can copy the good points from one, and the bad points of the other I correct in myself. And so you see these people out there who probably were great developers and have built a career where they're now very senior on top of it, and they've let the foundations rot. And I'm kind of very desperate to avoid doing that. So I do things like there's a Twitter bot called BBC Microbot that you can tweet a 280 character basic program to, and it will send you back a video of 10 seconds of that program running. And those sorts of things, or 1K coding contests, where you have some sort of very very constrained environment, so it's not going to eat too much of your life, but you can still do something really beautiful. So I try to do that because I just don't want to be one of those people. I don't want to be one of those people who used to be great.
So, yeah, I mean, you are a business leader now. And speaking as a business leader, what role do developers play within your own organization?
Oh, I think it's kind of easy for us because we're a deep tech company. They're kind of everything, right? You know, we have about 70 people working for Raspberry Pi trading now. So this is the bit of Raspberry Pi that makes the products that you know. But about 40 of those are developers, either software developers or, because we're also a hardware company, we have hardware developers as well. And there's an organization built around them so that we have a commercial function. As you know, we have a publishing organization. We have a communications function, but it's the developers that provide the kind of the meat that those other bits of the organization, exploit. And it's very different. I mean, it's very different if you're an organization that sells, you know, if you're an organization that sells car insurance, it's very different, right? You know, the red meat is different in your organization. It doesn't mean developers aren't as important, but it means they occupy a different place, I guess, from where they would if you're building AI chips or single board computers or writing an operating system.
Do developers develop, for want of a better word, a lot of transferable skills so that they can move from, say, you know, finance to betting to, you know, your type of organization? Or once you start down a single channel, are you kind of stuck?
I think there's a little bit of both, right? There are core skills, right? And those aren't actually, those don't tend to be necessarily language specific skills or platform or library specific skills. They tend to be skills about thinking. And ultimately, you know, go to kind of the charitable mission of Raspberry Pi, those are the things we're trying to teach. You know, nobody is trying to teach you, nobody is proposing that it's a good idea at school to teach kids the intricacies of how you use Amazon EC2 or something, you know, or Ruby on Rails or 6502 machine code for one that I happen to care about. No one's proposing that those skills, I mean, that's probably now a slightly legacy, that's a slightly COBOL-like legacy skill, sadly. but you know, no one's proposing that that's the thing we should be teaching children. What we should be teaching children are the underpinnings. And so to the extent that you have solid underpinnings, then you can take these skills anywhere. I've seen people, you know, what's probably the most extreme change? I mean, I've seen software engineers take their skills to chip design, right? If you look at the team that built VideoCore, which is the multimedia platform that powers Raspberry Pi, a lot of the most senior nominally silicon engineers, ASIC engineers, were actually software engineers. Who'd moved across. If you look at James Adams, who's now Chief Operating Officer at Raspberry Pi Trading, he was originally what we would call a systems engineer. So somebody who built the FPGA platform that we used to develop. So he's kind of a board level engineer. Built the FPGA platform that we used to develop VideoCore 3. Then moved into the ASIC team to design the VideoCore graphics architecture. Then moved back into, came and joined Raspberry Pi, moved back into board level engineering, now has a senior management role, but a senior management role which is informed by all of those technical skills. So you do see people move around a lot, and even kind of things that you would feel surprising where you think there's hardware and software, you see people even move across that boundary.
So how much code would you say Raspberry Pi's developers produce on a monthly basis?
Oh wow! What in KLOCs or something? Yeah. Are we at IBM? I used to work for IBM, and even there, nobody tried to measure my output in KLOCs. I honestly couldn't tell you. We don't really use those kind of metrics. A good month is a month where we've fixed the tactical stuff. So people report issues, we fix them. Where we've maybe made some progress on our kind of longer range but still tactical work. So an example of that would be moving up a Linux kernel revision. So we're just in the process of now moving, I think, to 5.4 at the moment. We were just in the process of an accelerated move to 5.9 as our standard kernel, because we need various pieces of infrastructure which have only appeared in the kernel between 5.4 and 5.9. So those are still tactical, right? Those are not, I wouldn't call them strategic, but they're longer term, and you need to kind of always be chipping away at that or getting ready for a new operating system release. A new user land release. And then if we've managed to make some progress on the longer term strategic stuff, and that might be doing software work in support of a new chip development. So say 2 years ago, a software team was pushing forwards. You know, we'd launched 3B Plus earlier that year. The software team was working through issues that had come out of the software as a result of that. And at the same time, they were doing a lot of software work in preparation for Raspberry Pi 4, in preparation for the final spin of 2711, which was the chip that would then go into Raspberry Pi 4. So it's that kind of like trying to keep three, if you think of it as keeping plates spinning, it's kind of three sets of plates. And one of the challenges for us, I think, as an organization is the technology we do, we're a deep tech company, the technology we do, the kind of pipeline depth gets longer all the time. So, you know, you're constantly thinking about, it used to be that we could launch a platform, write the software for a platform, launch the platform, polish the platform, get it kind of to a finished state, then start to think about the next platform. And what's happened over the years is is we've had more future platforms. So when we were working on Raspberry Pi 3 Plus, Raspberry Pi 4 was already a long way advanced. And what that means is it gets harder and harder and harder to decide which plate to spin. You're in the position where you, if you're not careful, you either have to sacrifice stability or incremental performance improvements on the current platform in order to allow your engineers to work on something that's going to happen in 3 or 4 years' time, or you more kind of more insidiously, everything's fine except you're letting your future rot. So that's what it boils down to is hiring more people. So we're again at the moment going through a bit of a hiring spree to try to get us the people we need to manage that pipelining.
Well, we're going to take a short break now, but when we come back, we will be talking more about the Raspberry Pi, its developer community, and what businesses can learn.
See you after the break. Welcome back. So, Eben, I think it's fair to say that the Raspberry Pi has kicked off a resurgence in hobby coding since it was launched in 2012. Has your experience with it taught you anything about the developer community and its role in business?
Well, I think it's taught us about the role of the open source developer community in business. Because, of course, you know, this is a relatively modern phenomenon that businesses come to rely on and interact with their developer community. You're not in that Balmer-esque way where, you know, when he's saying developers, 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 what he's talking about is I want a lot of developers to develop their applications on Windows so that this franchise I have, Windows, is worth a lot of money. Kind of increasingly when organizations are talking about developers, what they're talking about are people who are actually out there in the community developing fairly core parts of their infrastructure on a hobbyist basis or on or on some sort of other commercial basis. And I think we've obviously, you know, Raspberry Pi is built on GNU Linux. So it's built on the Linux kernel. It's built on the GNU userland. And so we kind of depend on a lot of, and particularly the Debian distribution of that. And so we depend a lot on third parties. I think what we've learned over the 8 years, and I think we learned this quite quickly, actually, was that I had an idea that we could put Raspberry Pi out there in a pretty minimum viable state. And that we could rely on the community or exploit the community to fix it for us, right? You know, to do everything that was necessary. There's a Neil Gaiman speech, isn't there, where he's talking about George R. R. Martin, and he says, "Yeah, George R. R. Martin is not your bitch. You know, it's not his job to finish Game of Thrones for you. He can if he wants, but you don't have some right to demand." That he does, and it was similar sort of experience that we discovered that the open source community aren't that for us, and that there are things that they do incredibly well, and the things that they maybe don't do so well. But critically, you can't demand that they do have the same priorities as you. And so what this has ended up with, what this has implied for us, is a much larger organization. A much larger software engineering organization inside Raspberry Pi than I'd imagined. I'd imagined that we would just have a software engineering organization to work on the firmware, so the closed source bits that run the multimedia deep inside the chip. But in practice, we, you know, well over half of the software development we do in house is being done on is pushing open source platforms forwards, but in pushing it in directions which matter to us. I guess we found ourselves contributing cash to open source projects as well, or paying. I mean, there's a large ecosystem now of consultancies which effectively sell you access to the best open source developers for particular platforms. So we do a lot of work with Igalia, based in Spain. They know more about the Mesa open source graphics world than anybody else in the world. And we have a team of, it's 5 people actually now. They started off as 3 people last year, but it's kind of grown to 5. And they push forwards the open source graphics, OpenGL and Vulkan graphics stack on the device. So I think we've kind of got a more nuanced perception of what our place in this ecosystem is. I think it's a healthier one in there.
So how many developers were you expecting to have on your initial software development team versus how many you eventually ended up with?
Well, I think it's important to emphasize that originally we had zero. So we had no employees when we launched, right? So we had a canned firmware from Broadcom and the Linux kernel for ARM 11. So we'd had a bit of volunteer effort, but we had no employed software engineers at all. I guess I'd imagine that ultimately we would, if we were reasonably successful, and reasonably successful was two or three people. Reasonably successful would be two or three people, and that would be on the back of, we sell 100,000 units a year, we'd make a few $100,000 of revenue, we'd be able to employ two or three people, and that would be enough to move the platform forward. And of course, it's ended up in both dimensions, it's ended up one or two orders of magnitude larger than that, one and a bit orders of magnitude larger.
It's kind of interesting because one of the uses of Raspberry Pi, you know, there's lots of cool little projects and stuff, but one of the base uses has always been to encourage children, you know, talking in a wide range of children, you know, sort of 18 down.
I was going to say 8 to 80 is usually the formulation. Sure.
We're all children at heart, really, yes. Really.
Well, see, it's Walt Disney, isn't it? It's adults are only children grown up anyway.
Very much. But, you know, you've talked a bit about the recruitment that you've been doing. Obviously, the skills gap is a big focus within the IT community, within the education community as well. Is that something that you have seen or experienced at all in your efforts to recruit more developers?
Yes, it's a nightmare. I don't only have I don't only have 40 engineers because I only want 40 engineers. I have 40 engineers because I only be able to find 40 engineers who are bright enough. We're not badly connected, and I think we are. You know, I think we're a reasonably attractive place to work. But it is very, very hard to find people who are really of caliber. I mean, I think you can find people who can push code around, but finding people who you can't, like we have, I mean, you wouldn't believe. It's very, very hard to convey the quality of the engineering organization at Raspberry Pi. It's sort of, I sometimes call people I can turn my back on. Mm. You know, that's what you want, right? You want people who will autonomously make great decisions. It's not about writing great code. I mean, do that. But it's about autonomously deciding what great code needs to be written and then writing that. So the point about Linux, moving Linux to 5.9 kernel. That's not like I didn't wake up one morning and say we should move to the 5.9 kernel. It's not even like engineering management woke up one morning and said we should move to the 5.9 kernel. The engineers just decided it was the right thing to do, and I got an email about it saying we're doing it. It's very hard. It's very hard to, and I have no interest in reviewing that decision because I know it'll turn out to be right, and I'll just make a fool of myself if I interject. And that's what's hard. That's what's hard.
I think that's a very important point, though, about developer management in general. I think ideally you want the kind of people where when they tell you a particular decision that an application or a code base should be taken in, that you just implicitly trust them. You want people who are going to tell you how they should be working and what they should be doing rather than the other way around.
Yes. I think if you have that kind of very, very picky approach to talent, and you see ourselves as a talent business, right? We're hiring people who want to do certain things. And kind of if you try and make somebody do something that they don't want to do or don't find interesting, they're never going to be as productive as if they or as happy as if you let them do what they want to do. So kind of the trick, I think, a little bit with an organization like ours is to get people who want to do broadly the stuff that needs to be done. And then it's like my job is to kind of bend people's vector. People have a vector they want to travel down, right? And you can bend the vector a little bit without damaging people's sort of motivation. But if you try and bend it radically and say, go do a completely different thing, then they're not going to be happy and they're not going to enjoy working for you and they're not going to be as productive. You can see what we do is we acquire talent, we look at the things that the talent can do, and then we try to, my job is to try to think of a bunch of things which are basically what the talent wants to do, bent a little bit maybe, the sum of which makes enough money to keep the business moving forward. Kind of crudely. And so what we're not doing is, there's another way of doing this, which is you have some things you want to do, and then you chop the thing you want to do up into roles, and then you go out to the market and you try and recruit the closest people to those roles. And that's pretty much broadly not what we do. and we have the luxury, we have lots of luxury. We're in a very luxurious position, actually. And so we, you know, this isn't necessarily a generalizable lesson, but it's certainly much more what's in my mind when I see somebody is, you know, we had a company do some layoffs in Cambridge this last quarter. And we went and snapped up some talent from there. And yeah, it was in the right kind of area, but we weren't really thinking very deeply about how do we, does this fit a hole that we've got. Mm. We're thinking, is it talent? And is it in broadly the right area? And we'll grab it as it goes, as it's going past, and then we'll think about what to do with it later on.
Yeah, it's interesting to hear the way that you talk about your developers, you know, that I think that there is a tendency to think of developers, programmers as like computer robots. Mm. robots, but you know what I mean, like robots who just go around and they create the code and then off they go, rather than you know, kind of talent who are effectively working in quite a creative space.
Mm. Yes, you know, code monkey, get up, get coffee, code monkey, get a job, right? And that's, you know, that's not, again, we're in a luxury position of not having to think about engineers like that. But I think it's a shame because I think that we've lost touch a little bit. It's back to sort of the point about writing basic programs that fit in a tweet or something. Yeah, there is there's a craftspersonship about what we do, and it actually feeds back into the education side. If you think one of the challenges about computing education, reform of computing education, is that a lot of the people who are involved in organizing it, who are very, very bright people, belong to one camp which sees computing as a branch of discrete mathematics, basically. There's another, I come from the other, so I'm weird because I programmed computers when I was a child, and I wrote computer games because I really wanted to do it on my BBC and on my Amiga. And so I actually come from the other domain, which is the craftsman. I'm a craftsman. And I have a PhD in computer science. So I went and learned the other stuff later on when, as a craftsman, I kept encountering people, a lot of people I was interviewing for my first startup, who knew all these things I didn't know, and it was just embarrassing. So I went and got myself a proper education. But that is a really important part, and it's something that I think when we're educating young people, we really need to, and that's why devices like Raspberry Pi, I think, are as important as having a good curriculum, because they give people a venue within which they can practice the craft. And if they practice the craft, they're much less likely to be code monkeys. They're much less likely to get pigeonholed as code monkeys. They're much more likely to be those kind of creative people whose employers describe them as talent rather than describing them as human resources, because they're not human resources. They're not there to be strip mined, right?
Yeah, it does make me all reminisce a little bit about being in, would have been in infant school with a BBC Micro and using Logo to make pictures where, you know, you are programming, but, you know, your robot's going around on the floor, or you're making some kind of, you know, graphical representation of what you've typed in.
That turtle, that kind of bluey, greeny turtle that was very ubiquitous in, I don't know who made it, but it was very ubiquitous in BBC World in the 1980s.
Yeah. I love the way you're going, yes, Adam. Everybody knows that you're secretly a child here.
I still use that thing.
Yeah, well.
Yeah, they were incredibly robust. Yes.
Mm. Yeah, we had an old school acorn in my primary school, big beige monster of a thing. So you've been running Raspberry Pi for about 12 years. Are there any tricks you've learned about running an effective dev team in that time?
Oh, probably not. That's what I have Gordon Hollingworth, our director of software engineering, for, I guess. Have Gordon and James working for me, I think, is the trick. I mean, it's kind of true actually. I mean, it's about the people. It's about the people you put in. So it's about having people who are reasonably self-managing, and to the extent you put managers in, having managers who still have that attitude towards the craft. So back to James. You know, Raspberry Pi 4 was designed by James. Raspberry Pi 5, when it happens in a few years' time, will almost certainly be designed by James. This is the guy who runs the entire hardware organization. So finding those people who still have the passion for the craft is really important. And I think that probably is a generalizable. A generalizable lesson. It'll become, if too many people take it on board as a generalizable lesson, then it will be awkward for us. but that's what Raspberry Pi is for. That's what the Raspberry Pi Foundation is for. It's to ensure that by the time that mindset becomes more ubiquitous, we have a large supply of craftspeople out there who can fill those roles.
Because I think that's important. I think a lot of organizations, particularly enterprise organizations, who are developing software without being, you know, software companies at heart, treat code and applications and programming in general with a kind of almost assembly line mindset. You know, it's just you put the bits in the place to make the thing do the thing, rather than taking a more, you know, as you mentioned, kind of creative, kind of craftsman-led approach to creating their applications. And I think adopting bits of that mentality can be very, very helpful.
There's a joy in it, right? I mean, it's just, I, you know, we have the problem with the word engineer, right? Your engineer is the person who comes around and fixes your boiler, right? And it's kind of can be hard to explain to parents why you would want your child to be an engineer. You know, they could be in overalls or, you know, in best case, a hard hat and a high-vis jacket. And you say to parents, like, your child will get to play with toys every day of their life. Imagine that someone will let you play with toys every day of your life, and you can maybe you'll be indoors in the warm if that's what you like, or maybe you'll be out on a building site in the middle of January if that's what you like. And they pay you money for it. You know, they don't even expect you to do it for free, right? And that joy is we've had kind of a really interesting 3 months at Raspberry Pi, where you've seen us kind of launch a number of very interesting products, and each one, you know, just the joy when you see something that I've contributed to at a very distant level. When you see that in the market is just, Raspberry Pi 4 has James's signature under the USB 3 connector. If you desolder the USB 3 connector,
really?
Raspberry Pi 4, it has James's signature.
That's amazing.
Right. And so that sense that you made a thing, or you were part of making a thing, and now it's in the world and people are using it, is just, it's great. And I don't think that just applies to single board computers or skyscrapers. You know, I think it applies to, you know, any piece of software that ultimately is used by a person, and that person is happy because they're using your software. You know, why? You know, people should feel like that. Organizations should help people feel like that. Look at the launch post that we do for the big Raspberry Pi products, for the 1, 2, 3, 4, the kind of tentpole releases. They have credits lists at the end. Go look at the Raspberry Pi 4 launch post. It has a credits list at the end that was 350 people long before I put anyone on it who worked for Raspberry Pi.
Wow.
Right? You know, and all of those people know that they, you know, I can put my, I'm the guy who did the DFT. I'm the guy who did the design for test in the chip. You know, I'm the person who figured out the panelization to go so that when the, you know, built at 9 up 3x3 panels as they go through the machine. I'm the guy who figured out that if I put this through at 9 up, I'd get 2% more efficiency out of the way that the PCBs tile into the big sheets at the factory in China than if we did it at 6 up. And that saved, you know, three pence off the design, which let us do this. You know, all of those people, all of them in that list will have a story about why Raspberry Pi 4 would not be as great as it is if it wasn't for them.
Sadly, that's all we have time for this week. Thank you once again to Eben Upton, founder of the Raspberry Pi Foundation, for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
And thanks to you for listening. If you liked the show, why not subscribe via your podcast app of choice? And if you can, leave us a rating and review. We'll be back next week for more insight and analysis from the world of IT. But until then, goodbye.
Bye. The IT Pro Podcast is brought to you by the Dennis Podcast Network.